There's a joke I like to tell about this older couple lived up in Vermont. And they'd been married, well, I think around 50 years. And the wife surprised the husband one day. She said, "I'd like a divorce." And he said, "Why?" She said, "Well, you never tell me you love me. I can't remember the last time was you told me you loved me." Now remember, these two are from Vermont. And you don't want to waste your words. She said, "Well, I told you when I married you that I loved you, didn't I?" "Yes. If I'd have changed my mind, I'd have let you know." I could see that with some couples, but I'm sure he showed his love for her in other ways. If she was paying attention, if he was paying attention. You need some senses to find out what's going on around you. It's not always going to be just right there in front of you. Sometimes it takes keen senses. And when I say that, I'm thinking of people like Beethoven, who kept composing even after he went deaf. He could hear the music in his head. Or Helen Keller, brilliant and a communicator, even though she was deaf and blind. Or the entertainer Ray Charles, blind since a childhood accident, but he sits down at a keyboard and puts out a tune with the best of them. Over on the fictional side, this is what detectives in novels do all the time. I think of the two best-known Agatha Christie detectives, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. They see and understand otherwise overlooked or ignored things. We can all see, but they focus in on them and come to understand what they're about. This all reminds me of something that would happen when my kids were younger. They're both in their late 30s now and have families of their own. But when they were still in school, we lived in Northeast Ohio, and it would often be my turn to pick them up from school or whenever. And we lived on a street called Cherry Lane, which was a short dead end, but it was a dog leg. So you'd turn onto Cherry Lane and go down a few houses, and then you'd bear to the left. And we were the third house from the far end on the right. And as soon as I got to that bend in the road, I would tell the kids, "Well, your mom is home," or, "No, she's not home right now." And this was before the days of cell phones, so I hadn't gotten on the phone to check her schedule. We were all pretty sure that because it was my turn to pick them up, she was busy with something. But I could tell if she was home or not. And for a couple of years, this confounded them. But it really was quite simple. Our house had an attached garage, and there was a door off the front porch with a kind of a glazed over window in it that faced the direction that we were driving in from. And just on the other side of the garage was another window. Now, my car obviously wasn't in there because we were in driving it. My wife drove the van, the household van, anyway. So as soon as we came around the corner, I could see through backlit from that other window, I could see if the roof of her van was in that garage or not. And the kids, it took them forever to figure that out. I didn't have any ESP or anything like that. I could just see that her car was there in that window. This is a bit what prophets do. They don't know things that we can't kind of figure out for ourselves, but they just have a keener sense for them. And particularly when it comes to what God is up to and what's happening around us spiritually and in terms of our place with God. So that prophets, they offer warnings and promise. They communicate dismay and comfort and sadness and gladness. They are the ones that among other things, help reveal where we are with God, where God is in the world. God is revealed through Scripture, through prayer, through the prophets, through reason, which is applied to us observing nature, the world around us. And God can be sensed by somebody with those keen senses. Now, what we call salvation history, which is basically the history of humanity, we know that humans are loved, that we're made in the image of God. But we also know all too well that we're subject to sin and evil and death, that we can be hurtful and unjust. Those latter things make God sad, dismayed. We're given warnings because, particularly when it comes to sin, we have walked right into that ourselves, often as not. But God also has always offered promise and comfort and grace and will complete salvation. So if we kind of take a quick walk through what we call salvation history, yeah, we start at the beginning. God creates the world in those poetic 7 days. And then we come right away in the book of Genesis to the story of Adam and Eve, the fall, the apple and the serpent in the garden. In fact, kind of ask yourself, what are the first things that happen after Adam and Eve have consumed the apple? Well, the first thing is they're just ridden with shame and guilt, and they go and hide themselves and try and make some makeshift clothes out of whatever they can get their hands on from the garden. The next thing that happens is that God comes to them. In the cool of the evening, God is walking in the garden. He seeks out Adam and Eve and talks with them. So the very first time human beings have gotten into trouble and gotten crosswise with God, God is there with them and talking with them. Then the stories go on where human beings, yeah, we thrive, but we get in trouble. We get the story of Cain and Abel and that first murder, brother on brother. The Tower of Babel, where humans get a little too full of themselves and God needs to put some brakes on that. The flood, where sin is just everywhere, and so God's going to have a remnant, Noah and his family, and a pair of each of the animals is going to ride out the flood and start anew. And not only that, but then God puts the rainbow in the sky as a commitment to never cleanse the earth by that kind of catastrophic flood again. That's how God is, saving and sustaining and pointing towards the future, towards salvation. God establishes the covenant with Abraham and Sarah. And then we hear the stories of the patriarchs. I mean, think of the time when Jacob's sons, 10 of his 12 sons, get jealous of the second youngest, Joseph. And they want to get rid of him. First thought is to kill him, but they're too timid to do that. So they do what I'd often thought of doing with my brothers and sell them to a camel caravan on its way to Egypt. God somehow took that and turned that into something that was going to be a foundational piece in salvation history. This is what gets Israel down into Egypt. 400 years later, the Hebrews are still in Egypt. They're still an oppressed group, still made to act as slaves, be enslaved, and God is ready to free them. So we get the Exodus. He raises up Moses, and they go through the desert for 40 years. during which God makes sure they're fed, giving them manna from heaven, water from a rock, safety from the dangerous serpents that are all around. He's a guide to them day by day in a column of smoke and night by night in a column of fire. Even though in the midst of that, the people rise up and, for instance, gather all their gold, fashion it into a calf, and decides that's a nice shiny object to worship, God still calls them back into covenant by giving them the Ten Commandments, by continuing to lead them to the promised land. That is God's nature, to move towards salvation. When God's people demanded a monarch, against his own advice, God gives it to them, knowing what monarchs and authoritarians like that do. But God also takes that and turns that on its head. We have the wonderful song of Hannah, how God is going to favor the poor, how God is going to do things God's way and not the way of those who have status in the world. And the calling of Samuel. Ruth, who's a total outsider, not part of the people of God, just marries into the family, becomes the grandmother of King David. And as God's people go through the Babylonian captivity, the destruction of the first temple, God stays with them. But just as with that very first story where Adam and Eve were culpable within that, and there's other things going on like that serpent, the people of God are culpable, and God sends prophets. These people with these keen senses who offer warning and promise, dismay and comfort, who show sadness and gladness. They take Israel to task, the prophets do, reiterate the covenant and God's promises. God keeps moving ahead. And today, we celebrate somebody who's sometimes thought of as the last great Old Testament prophet for Christians, John the Baptist. A Jewish preacher active in the area of the Jordan River, roughly the same age as Jesus, maybe 6 months older. And John anticipated the Messiah was coming soon. And he announces that. He tells people, and then he identifies Jesus as the one to turn your attention to. Jesus himself identifies John as the heir of the status of the prophet Elijah, who was said to come again. Yes, John the Baptist is a prophet. His birth, like the birth of people like Samuel, was announced by an angel. And according to the Gospel of Luke, John and Jesus were relatives, but John was to go before Jesus. As the prophet Malachi says, "Lo, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes." Or the prophet Isaiah, a voice cries out in the wilderness, "Prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for God." John not only quotes that, but he is in the wilderness wearing his rather iconoclastic clothing of some rough leather, just like we hear in 2 Kings about a hairy man with a leather belt around his waist, Elijah, the prophet. So God has always been moving towards working out with humans how to overcome our being subject to sin and evil and death, and at the same time not become just automata or robots or little computers just programmed by God. No, we do get our free will, and we'll get our freedom and salvation in time. And that has always been so. The word Redeemer is mentioned in the Old Testament 20 times. and in God sending prophets to tell us about the Messiah to come. We can just start with the words of Handel's Messiah. It goes well beyond this. But you may remember some of this from Handel's Messiah. Behold, a virgin shall conceive, Isaiah tells us. Or much later in Isaiah, O thou that tellest good tidings to Zion, to God's people. Or back towards the beginning of Isaiah again, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. I mean, we can look around us, just look at the headlines going through the internet today and yesterday. We can understand the land of the shadow of death. But our hearts and our souls understand the prophet Isaiah, who says, For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And back to Micah, we even hear prophets giving specifics about the one who would come centuries later. You, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient of days. Today we remember that final prophet in the line who assured us of God's promise and grace as we continue to look forward to our yearly celebration of the incarnation. Amen.